Emma Donoghue captivated readers a few years ago with her award-winning novel, Room. The book was told through the eyes of a five-year-old boy who's held captive with his mother in a shed in his father's backyard. Room was very loosely based on a true story, ripped from the headlines, as they say. Now Emma Donoghue returns to real life as a source for her fiction. Her new novel, Frog Music, is based on the 1876 murder of a woman named Jenny Bonnet. Bonnet was a gun-toting freethinker who lived in and around San Francisco. She was arrested several times for dressing as a man as well as for theft. Bonnet's murder was never solved. I asked Emma Donoghue how she first heard of Jenny Bonnet.
Somebody else's book, of course. Books always beget books. So there's a wonderful sort of compendium of Victorian eccentric women and rebellious women called Wild Women by Autumn Stevens, who lives in the Bay Area. And Jenny Bonnet's murder case was just one of many sort of historical nuggets that she presents. And I was immediately drawn to it because she sounded such an oddball. She caught frogs for a living. I don't know anyone else about whom that can be said. She supplied frogs to the restaurant trade, and she'd been in a reformatory, and she was a child actress gone wrong. And, you know, she just seemed the perfect person to get shot dead through a window by persons unknown at the age of 27. It just sounded like a novel waiting to happen.
They always do say truth is stranger than fiction, right?
It's true. And one thing I love about using real historical people is that they make me include things that are odder and grittier than I would naturally think to. For instance, the other woman in the room when Jenny got shot, Blanche Benoit, was a French burlesque dancer. And if I had been inventing Blanche, I would probably have thought to supply her with a man, but I wouldn't have thought to supply her with her man's best friend, who was really close to them and got very closely involved in the events of that summer and a kind of a feud with Jenny. So that second man, I wouldn't have thought to add him. So history just forces me to include odder and therefore more gripping storylines.
Now, this story actually took place, I think, 1876. So this is before the great earthquake and fire in San Francisco. And I was curious, when you decided that this is a story you were going to pursue, how you tracked down the records of these people and the crime.
I just had to use some lateral thinking. For instance, we don't have the actual police arrest files, but we have newspapers. I mean, they survived because they were disseminated. We have the city's, San Francisco's own municipal reports that are published once a year, and they seem really tedious. And then you find gems of data in there. For instance, they list the property of everybody who's died. So I found that Jenny Bonnet, when she died, left behind only her Colt pistol, which she was always flashing around and picking fights in bars with. And then a pawnbroker turned up and said, actually, that belonged to me. So she had a borrowed pistol. That was just such a great image for what a chancer she was.
There's only one fictional character in your book?
There's three or four, maybe, but there are about 26 real ones, yes. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to make things up when I need to. You know, some of my previous historical novels have been based on just a tiny bit of evidence and mostly invented. But in this case, San Francisco as a city just seemed absolutely full of rivetingly interesting, odd people who had to make it into my novel.
Well, in fact, San Francisco of this particular story was really the Wild West. It's after the Gold Rush. There's a lot of different kinds of people there. And this happened in... It was swelteringly hot, and there was a smallpox epidemic going on.
And I didn't need to make any of that up. It's extraordinary. All these different elements converged, and I was writing about French immigrants who chose to live in Chinatown. So, you know, there were all these interesting ethnic and racial tensions going on. And one technique I used to suggest the cultural richness and craziness of the city was the music, because I hate historical fiction that kind of grinds to a halt while the author explains things. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to throw in French songs, Irish songs. You know, we'll have a Chinese opera playing on the block. We'll have the organ grinder pumping out the latest Verdi. There'll be, you know, a black street musician will be singing a spiritual. I will just imply the cultural mixture.
I was going to ask you about those songs, because they are sprinkled throughout the whole book, and some of them are songs that we realize we know as we're
reading. Yes, like
The
Man on the Flying Trapeze.
Exactly. It got me to wondering, this is something that we read, and whether in your head you were hearing it on a screen, a big screen, a little screen. I mean,
I was looking up multiple versions of those songs. Yeah, I know all you can have in the book is the lyrics, though actually the audiobook, I asked the publishers to hire an actress who could burst into song at all the relevant points. So she does, which I think is thrilling. And of course, there has been a lot of film interest in this book, but I would never write a novel merely as a means to writing a screenplay. That would be very perverse, you know, to write so many words and then throw most of them away. So for me, I suppose I was hoping that a lot of the tunes are familiar enough enough that people could add them in their heads, or at least could get a sense of the mood of the piece. You know, if it's some kind of bluesy number, people will be able to sort of fill in the blanks themselves. I mean, you know, writing fiction, it's so much a matter of suggestion, and then your readers fill in the rest. They contribute so much. They really bring it to life themselves.
I'm talking with Emma Donoghue, and her new novel is called Frog Music, and that's the musical part of it. The frog has multiple meanings as well.
Including the French, yes. Frog was slang for the French, and frogs were the animal that Jenny Bonnet actually made a good living supplying to the restaurants of San Francisco.
Now, you chose to tell the story through Blanche's eyes, this French prostitute who, in some sense, I asked you to start describing Jenny, but this is really Blanche's story.
It is, and that surprised me too, because I had sort of assumed that I would tell it from at least half Jenny's point of view, and then I got really interested in what a slippery character she was in several senses, how enigmatic she was. Lots of people thought they knew her, and then new details would start to emerge in the newspaper reports after her death. And there were clearly aspects of her past that she kept shut away as if they weren't her anymore. So at one point, you know, there was a report of something she'd done about 10 years before the crime. And I thought, hang on, could this be a different Jeanne Bonnet? So this sense of multiple selves, this playful attitude to identity, which is so seems so modern, but there she was in the 1870s. For instance, she was cross-dressing, but with no attempt to actually disguise herself as a man. So she was this proto-modern figure. And I decided to capture some of that enigmatic and playful quality. It was actually better not to tell it from her point of view, because I wanted her to be always sort of dancing at arm's length, you know, not quite answering our questions.
But what she also is a catalyst for Blanche to upturn everything that has been her bedrock.
Absolutely. I mean, I knew from the sources that this was the story of a friendship which went wrong, and that clearly the women became friends, and then Blanche broke up with her man, and there was a feuding situation, and next thing, Jenny's dead. But what I didn't know was how it all went down moment by moment between them all. And I decided that I wanted to make it the story of a kind of a brief collision, a very brief friendship, less than a month. And I make it a literal collision, right, when Jenny on her high wheeler bicycle rides straight into Blanche. But I wanted to show Blanche's life falling down like a house of cards. And I decided to make Blanche a prostitute who really likes sex and who even likes the sex trade, because I've written before about prostitution in very grim terms, a novel of mine, Slammerkin, about a street prostitute in the 18th century. And this time I thought, okay, I'm going to take a risk here, and I'm going to present Blanche as somebody who thinks that this is working for her just fine. She likes pleasure, she likes clothes, she likes drink, she likes performance, that this all seems just fine. And then I will have the novel start to kind of unpick the threads. And I wanted in particular to have Blanche be the good time girl who says yes to everything. So I wanted to make Blanche a kind of a cool girl of the 1870s, who at a certain point in the book will find a reason to say no, will find some core of strength, and also who will find her own motherhood, because Blanche had this missing baby, and that becomes a really central part of the novel.
You have written historical fiction before this. How beholden are you to the historical record, to the actual facts, and how much do you, as a novelist, because that is what you are, feel that you can just use the facts as a jumping off point?
It depends on the type of historical fiction writer you are. Some of them pour scorn on the very notion of research and say, oh, it's all fiction anyway, and they just let themselves sort of swim in the soup of possibility. I really enjoy being quite respectful of the facts. I enjoy that particular challenge, you know, to say I'm going to work around these dates here, and I'm going to, you know, if it seems odd that Blanche went off to a saloon that evening, I'm going to try and figure out an interesting reason for her to do that instead of just changing everything. So I love the kind of grit of the real, and I find that readers like it too. And of course, it does kind of double my labor, but you know, if you're counting the work hours you're putting into a book, then you're not a real writer anyway, because you have to write your books in a spirit of obsessive curiosity, you know, or just a passion for the material. Somehow I like having those two hats of historian and fiction writer, and so I will struggle for maybe 3 days to find somebody in the census records. You know, I'll be peering over the website, trying every variation on their surname, and then when I get to the end of that line and I can't find any information, then I think, fine, I'll make it all up. So I do enjoy both, and it's sort of perverse. Sometimes I'm not sure whether I want to find the facts or not.
The internet must make historical fiction much easier than it was.
It has transformed it, especially for this novel of mine. I think because the events are relatively modern, I was able to track down a lot of these people in ships' passenger lists, sometimes voting records, birth and baptismal records from back in France or Ireland, and great little nuggets of information. I'll never forget the day I finally found Blanche and Arthur on the ship's passenger list arriving in America. And Arthur had told journalists that he was the son of a prestigious chemist in Paris. And I was thinking, I don't think so, because you ended up as a really sleazy pimp in San Francisco. And so I found that on the ship's passenger list, he had said he was an acrobat. And I thought, oh, that rings a lot more true. So, you know, you develop a kind of an ear. And I love that challenge of trying to find whatever little facts do remain about these people.
How much pressure was on you after the huge success of Room to knock it out of the park, as we say, with this book?
Well, I knew my publishers were, you know, hoping for another bestseller. So they've been extremely relieved that Frog Music has started showing up on bestseller lists. But they never tell you what to write if you're a writer of literary fiction. You know, they don't make the mistake of trying to turn you into a reliable brand. I think they definitely were happy I had another novel rather than short stories, which are harder for them to sell. But they never said a word about what they thought it should be. Nobody tried to push me towards the contemporary or the headline grabbing. Publishers are really... they're really respectful of the writing process, in my experience. They've never, ever told me what to do.
Emma Donahue, she explores 19th century San Francisco and a real-life unsolved murder in her new novel. It's called Frog Music. It's The Record from KUOW with Ross Reynolds. I'm Marcy Silman.